Good evening, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. This is our second week on the Gripped Network, so if you are listening to this on SoundCloud, I would recommend you instead go to the Gripped website, where you will find us in the podcasting section. Today we've got a couple of things we want to talk about. I want to open by asking you a question. Have you been hearing that the world of, or the lungs of the world, is on fire? I know I have. I've heard it repeated dozens of times, I would say. Michael, at this point, every celebrity, NGO, governmental organization, the UN.
But you're annoyed by this. I'm old enough to remember when this came around the first time. In the 70s, it was a lot of, we were constantly talking about in primary school about the Amazon and it being the lungs of the world. But yeah, it's all getting a bit tedious because it's the lungs of the world during the day, but it's not at the night, it's the bellows of the world.
Yeah, so here's the thing. This is obviously in relation to the Amazon being on fire, which we want to open by talking about a little bit. And not to say it's not a serious matter, but the way it's being represented in the media is not, shall we say, totally accurate, because frankly, most of the people talking about it have no clue what they're talking about at all. So this idea that the Amazon is the lungs of the world is not correct. For a very simple reason. Most large forests don't actually, they're fairly oxygen neutral because they produce oxygen, yes, but then they also absorb oxygen. So large forests, relatively oxygen neutral. The idea that the Amazon is the lungs of the world is nonsensical. Now, if they were talking about carbon capture and saying that the burning of those trees is terrible for the release of carbon, they'd be absolutely right. But they're not. It's like someone sent around a press release that just said, this is what we're going to say, and every celebrity in the world received that press release.
You know, if you're a busy celebrity, you know that there are lots of things you have to care about. And we know, so dolphins and whales and Tibet, the climate generally, but the Amazon rainforest especially, because, well, it's got those lovely indigenous people there with those fantastic hats, and they've never met anybody, and they shoot at planes. So you have to care about the Amazon, and you don't have time to be ginning up on all the details, or indeed finding photographs that are actually of the Amazon.
No, I mean, Macron shared an article or a photo of the Amazon on fire that was from 20 years ago.
Well, yeah, but then there were other photographs which were of the deep south, the south of Brazil near the Pampas. Then there was photographs of Venezuela. There were photographs of Bolivia. Of course, there are indeed fires happening elsewhere, and including in Bolivia. But Bolivia, I don't know. Is it because? But Evo Morales is the boss in Bolivia, isn't he?
Yes.
And he's a lovely lefty, wingy kind of guy. And Bolsonaro we all hate, because he's a monster and a fascist and a Nazi probably. So it's his fault that, in fact, it's not just his fault. He's probably deliberately burning the Brazilian rainforest because of Mercosur. And I love the fact, have you seen that Leo has taking a principled position. He will not sign to Mercosur until the fires are put out.
I was absolutely thrilled to see that Ireland and France, the two largest or most dependent upon agriculture countries in the EU, have both taken a unified moral stance against beef exports or imports from Brazil due to this terrible ecological tragedy. None of the other ones, though. The only people who seem to care are people who are dependent upon agricultural.
You're very cynical, Gary. I think that's very sad in someone so young. I'm sure that this is completely unconnected one to the other.
Oh no! I mean, it's not like the fact that agriculture is a massive part or was a massive part of the initial deforestation of the Amazon is a well-known fact and would have been immediately obvious to anyone who even looked at what countries were involved in this deal.
Of course, that's exactly the thing. That's the thing that got me. It's like, you know, shut up and say nothing, because if you're going to say that, all you're going to do is draw attention to the fact that either you really haven't been paying attention, or you're asleep. Because Mercosur deal has been going on for years and years and years. Yeah, I mean, this has been a long time to get to the point where they're actually going to sign Mercosur. Now we know, because we've been told ad nauseum, that the Brazilians are deforesting in order to create land for grazing for cattle to send, usually in this scenario narrative, they like to say McDonald's, because McDonald's is a big, bad, you know, multinational and American, so it works with the evil ranchers. Now, that was known fact. We knew that the expansion of the agriculture in Brazil was connected to the extension. Soybeans and beef, more soybeans and beef. And Leo has only just discovered this. This has only just become into his attention. Leo, really, you need to read a paper, read a newspaper. It's also, we have to assume that eventually they will get the fires under control and Leo will be able to get off of his perch, having made his principal stand, of course, and say, well, now that they have taken my words to heart, they have responded, they have taken it seriously, and have put the fires out. Because they wouldn't have done it had Leo not threatened.
No, it's a pointless exercise which will enable Leo to say he's made some sock to the environmental movement without ever having any real risk. But here's an interesting, on the lungs of the world point. Here's a quote from Dan Napstead, who is an NGO called Air Innovation, which are based around the Amazon, and they do climate friendly rural development, innovative approaches to sustainable environments, blah blah blah. You get the idea.
Yeah, sure.
He's one of the Greens. And he was asked, lungs of the world comment. And here's his comment. It's total bullshit. There's no science behind it. Yes, the Amazon produces a lot of oxygen, but it uses the same amount of oxygen through respiration, so it's all a wash anyway.
That's pretty good. Now, it is worth, we should point out, that there are people living in the Amazon, and for whom this place is home, and for whom this fire is obviously an absolute disaster. And if we're looking at it from the environmental point of view, while forests are very good at carbon capture, when they burn, they are very good also at carbon release. I don't know, did we just talk about, did you see that story? It was reported in The Guardian from the report done in one of the big science mags about the best way to deal with climate change would be plant trees.
Yes, we did a show on it, actually.
Yeah, I remember that. I was looking at other some afterwards. The figures are absolutely incredible. But the best figure about it, which I hadn't remember, I don't remember finding at the time, was, do you know what the cost would be? Do you remember?
I know, I didn't see a cost, actually.
The costing, just with the planting, now, remembering that most of the land, they deliberately excluded urban land and arable land. They left in some grazing land because they said, you know what? And in lots of places in grazing land, you can actually plant trees. Because they're not, the plant doesn't assume equal density of planting everywhere, you know? Different places are going to have different levels of density of planting different types of trees. But he said, even in grazing land, actually can benefit from having a degree of reforestation. But the baseline cost of simply just the tree plant was estimated initially at around 300 billion.
Which, in comparison to most environmental plans, is nothing.
It's cheap as chips.
Like nothing.
It's cheap as, it's absolutely nothing. You divide that. I mean, honest to God, you could probably fund it out of, if you got enough tech billionaires in the US and China together, you could probably fund it by themselves. Let alone getting governments involved or international organizations. And it would reduce something like, within 40 years, a third or more of all of the carbon that had ever been introduced into the atmosphere. not just what we're doing now. So I think that's fabulous. And therefore, I'm at a moment, I'm very pro-tree. So whatever else is happening, I think we should give the Amazon rainforest a help out. However, just to the point we were saying about, you know, Brazil and way after Bolsonaro, even though actually there were more fires under Lula than there far more under him. Siberia has been burning for quite some time, apparently. And according to the Russian authorities, they've burned more than 11,500 square miles of Siberia.
Hmm.
That's a lot. Isn't that a lot? That seems to me to be a lot. 11,500 square miles of Siberia. That seems to me to be a lot of Siberia. But yet, we hear very little of it. Not that much... Not that much loveliness in Siberia, I suppose, but there you go.
There's also, just on another point they're talking about, and they're talking about massive increases in rates of fire in the Amazon in Brazil, and forest fires in Brazil generally. It is higher than last year.
Yeah.
It's substantially higher than last year. It's about 80% higher than the number of fires in Brazil last year. It's only 7% higher than the average over the last decade, though.
Right.
And if you go back, there was a period between about 2003 and 2008 where you were looking at double this every year.
Hmm.
So even by historical trends, this is not the worst fires we've seen in the Amazon. It's always one of those weird things where someone will go, well, you know, this is double, and then they will just pick a year that just seems random.
Yeah.
That always makes me interested in what the trend is immediately before that year.
Yeah, you want to know what the year after or the year before were.
Because I mean, you see this with media and you see it with academics as well, actually. They will pick the year that gives the most dramatic rise so they can present it in the most startling fashion. Even if that's openly misleading.
Indeed. It's like our friends we discussed before. They meant when Leo announced he was going to go through with the alcohol pricing, minimum alcohol pricing, on the back of the success of the Scottish minimum alcohol pricing at the end of its first year, they had succeeded in reducing alcohol consumption in Scotland by 3%. Just baldly there. But again, of course, when you looked at the figures, you discovered that the previous year, alcohol consumption without minimum alcohol pricing had fallen by 4%. And the year before that, it had fallen by another 5%. But the year before that, it had fallen by 4%.
Yeah, and you could actually make the argument the alcohol pricing was driving up consumption.
You could.
It was falling by smaller amounts.
Yeah, because it was the smallest decline we'd seen in 4 years. So you thought, well, obviously it's having a negative effect there somewhere. But to throw the figure out there, documentary context, and hope to God nobody asks any questions.
It's one of those, you might question, like, why are we covering this at all? Surely it is an important story, and surely media should be covering it. And yes, it is an important story, and yes, media should cover it, because while this happens every year, it is interesting to know about, and it's good to know about, particularly why a lot of this burning is done, which is related to the planting of soya for animals, primarily. But this is the thing the media does. It takes things, and then it warps them, and it amplifies them, and then it causes you to have a distorted and fearful view of things, and particularly in relation to environmental issues, where they seem to be on this sort of the apocalypse is not nigh, it is now. And I don't think that's healthy for people. Yes, these are important things, but a lot of the reporting on environmental issues is clearly designed to cause fear and anxiety. And I don't think that's helpful because, frankly, people who are afraid do not make good decisions. They do stupid things because they feel they have
to. No, but fear is the biggest driving force on this particular issue. A lot of issues, let's face it. I don't suppose it was ever any different. But certainly we live in an age where most of the news is driven by fear.
I do like the fact that, you know, if you go back 10 years, you would see a lot of academics talking about how right-wing politicians thrived on fear and that they wanted people to be afraid. Mm-hmm. And then you look to today, and right-wing politicians are mostly kind of going, well, economic growth and prosperity. And left-wing academics and politicians are going, if you don't vote for us, you and your entire family will burn to death. Everything you love will die.
Yeah. But it's, One of the classic examples that we live with all the time, and not to diminish it, because obviously we are very attached to our children, but is the attitude towards the safety of children. And the light, and one of the obsessions that is across the world, but say particularly the United States, regarding the abduction of children by strangers. Now, that is vanishingly rare. But I think Jonathan Haidt writes about this. He says that one of it's a consequence of a couple of things. There were, in the late 70s, early 80s, there were two or three well-known abduction cases where young children were abducted, which coincided with the arrival of the 24-hour news stations in the United States. Now, so the problem with 24-hour news is you have to have news all the time, and of course, but you don't. So you recycle the news every half hour, same news, same news, same news, same news. And they'd never seen this before. So what they were faced with was, with the breaks of 3 months with these three high-profile cases, every half hour, a child was being abducted. Well, same child. This, and it inculcated this terrible sense of terror into the parents of that generation and the children. And now that to the extent that you can be arrested if you send your 10-year-old child 50 yards down the street to go to the shop to get a pint of milk because you've let them out by themselves. It's fear. It's terror. It's not real. In a sense, it's real, but it's not based on any realistic likelihood. Sadly, a child is far more likely to be harmed by a member of its immediate circle.
There's two interesting drives here. There's one, there's the drive from media to generate interest, to get your story to go as wide as possible.
Yeah.
And therefore, fear and sensationalization is a massive driver. It's also the fact a lot of these people, frankly, have no fucking clue what they're talking about, though. Okay, and you'll see it in the Amazon. I'd say most of the people who repeated the lungs of the world thing, which, again, may be seen as a small thing, thought it was true. Because they don't know enough about the issue to know it's not, and everyone else was saying it. But where I also saw it recently is David Koch died. David Koch, for those of you who don't know, was a... he and his brother, the Koch brothers, are sort of the... would be seen as the right-wing version of George Soros.
Yeah.
They are highly involved philanthropists. They themselves, their family, owned an oil extraction company. Although I think they branched out into many other things later in life. They were billionaires... incredibly wealthy people, and they donated heavily to a lot of particularly Republican causes. And when he died, he was referred to as a conservative philanthropist. There's only one problem with that. David Koch is not a conservative.
He was a liberal in many ways, or a libertarian.
He actually ran himself in the, I believe, the 1980s for president of the United States as a member of the Libertarian Party. He considered himself a member or a libertarian. He acted as a libertarian. He didn't give money to causes he saw as too conservative, unless they were political, in which case it was very much a sort of, you know, this is the lesser evil type option.
It was marriage of convenience, except for the Republicans.
Yeah, but when you look at where he put most of his money, it was into legitimately libertarian causes. Anyone I've talked to who knows the man say he was a deep and committed libertarian. When you look at his social policies, they were all libertarian. It was legalization of prostitution, of drugs, open borders.
Yeah, famously, on the subject of open borders, which people associate with Donald Trump and Republicans separating families and putting children in cages, Bernie Sanders was challenged about being an open borders guy. And Sanders snapped back, open borders? That's a Koch brothers theory. That's nothing to do with me. Bernie was quite right. Bernie's not an open borders guy, but the Koch brothers were. It's going to be hard now, isn't it? The Koch brother just doesn't have the same...
No, I will say I did get a bit of enjoyment. Not from his death, because I don't really get the whole dance on people's graves thing, and also he was close enough to me ideologically, I wouldn't want it anyway. But I did, his death was announced, and the more progressive wing, particularly in America, of the left, just gleeful, delighted he was dead. I saw, you know, the actor Ron Perlman?
Yeah.
He sent out a tweet that said, I hope the Koch brothers are reunited as quickly as possible.
Lovely.
And there was a great deal of that coming from left-wing personalities, from people in the media. delighted he was dead. I believe he died of cancer. He also, by the way, over the course of his life, apparently donated $137 million to MIT purely for cancer research.
Yeah.
But then it came out nearly immediately afterwards that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was on the US Supreme Court, had to not step down because she's still on the court, she just won't be there for cases, because her cancer, pancreatic cancer, has had a resurgence. And there was just this very quick turnaround from people to, it's great this man died, to, well, anyone who could say anything negative about Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying of pancreatic cancer is a monster.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe these two things are closer than they appear to be.
Yeah, listen, the Romans, maybe, were De Mortis Nolisi Bonum. So, if you can't think of something nice to say, say nothing.
As they say, Michael, speak ill of the dead. So, just before we close up, I wanted to also touch briefly on the G7 is meeting.
The G7, this is the closest thing we have had at international relations to a comedy def jam for a very long time. It is absolutely at least, shall we say, the northern half of it is a dysfunctional family at the moment. The Germans and the French, who generally speaking are on very nice terms, cooing and billing, have a bit of a falling out. Merkel is perceived by the French as being a soft peddling a bit with Boris, and also she kind of slapped Macron on the Mercosur deal when Macron was making all sorts of posing, a bit like our own dear Leo on the issue of Mercosur and Bolsonaro and the Amazon fires. And Merkel kind of basically said, "Well, for God's sake, would you stop? We're not going to throw up an incredibly important and complicated trade deal because of fires in the Amazon."
So for those who aren't aware, the G7, more technically the Group of Seven, is effectively, it's a bit of a weird one to describe because it's nearly just a high-powered dining club.
That's all it is, really.
It's basically the leaders of what I describe as the seven largest advanced economies in the world, which, if you actually look at them on scale, not really true anymore.
You see, once upon a time it was true. Once upon a time it started off as the G5, and it was the five largest economies. Then a terrible thing happened in the 80s, I think, which was there was a redefinition of the GDP of Italy, and they included the black market. And suddenly, and this was also when the British economy wasn't going so well, and the Italians came in as having a bigger economy than the Brits. Now, rather than, which would have been horrible, say, "Oh, we're going to have to kick out somebody and bring somebody in." They said, no, what we'll do is we'll expand it and we'll make it the G7 and we'll bring in Canada. Was it Canada as well?
So it was the 70s when Canada came in, and then it became the Group of Six, and then it became a Group of Seven. And then until about 2014, 15, Russia was in it, and then it was the gang of, or Group of Eight.
But was it the G7 plus one? Oh, yes, and then Putin invaded the Ukraine, or Crimea,
yeah,
Crimea, and that all, they didn't like that. So they said, "No, you can't come anymore."
So it's Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, the United States, and the European Union in the G7. Now, those among you who are literate may have noted that that is eight, but we don't question that because, frankly, as we've briefly walked through, the naming convention is nonsense anyway. And technically, the EU is just there as an invitee.
It's an observer.
So what this thing does, it meets every year, and it's to show that these advanced economies can come together and offer guidance and direction and come to a decision as to how certain things over the next year should be handled, mostly economic matters. But this year they had a bit of a problem because Trump last year signed off on the statement they released at the end of it and then immediately came out and went, "No, that was all nonsense."
Yeah.
And so this year, because it's in France this year, and I think it's in America next year, Macron decided they wouldn't have a statement. There would be no statement at all. And this has created what I would say has been my favourite political farce of the last while. Because now, instead of just Trump being someone who's off record, everyone is saying different things. I mean, everyone is saying, like, oh no, we did this. And then actually we did this. You've had the same government changing its mind repeatedly. And you can just see the reporters who were covering it getting more and more frustrated because they've no idea what's actually happening. Because no one seems to have any idea what's happening.
No.
So there have been a couple of things. Like they said that Macron came out and said, oh, we've agreed that we will all approach Iran and we will, you know, seek to bring them to the table. And Trump came out and said, well, we're just going to do our own thing anyway so they can do what they want.
The states are absolutely, it's night and day, the position between the EU and the states regarding Iran. And that was never going, I don't know what the hell Macron was on about, that was never going to fly.
No, and then Macron actually invited the foreign minister of Iran to the G7 and didn't tell anyone. But then when it came out, he hadn't told anyone, actually said, actually, we gave the Americans 24 hours notice, which was a bit, didn't look great for Merkel, as Merkel had by that point already told a reporter they hadn't told her. So they're dealing heavily with Iran, and Trump is pushing to bring back Russia. The European Union is saying we can't bring back Russia because they don't, apparently their line is not Crimea anymore, it's that they don't have Western democratic norms.
Yes.
And Trump, and this is a weird situation because Trump actually gave what I think is a very solid answer. Trump apparently said that there's no point discussing the issue without Russia, given Russia's military, economic, and geopolitical interests in the area, and that the failure to involve Russia was part of why the Syrian conflict had gone the way it had, which is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
So Trump is now giving people apparently much needed primers on the geopolitics of the Middle East, and doing so correctly.
It's a very, very scary world.
I just the image of Trump having to say, well, no, we can't do that because of these geopolitical considerations.
You got Boris in the middle of this all, desperately trying to work out what the hell he's going to do next. And none of the Europeans, no, the Germans and the French not really sort of trying to be standoffish. But the Italians probably being terribly friendly, because although they don't know themselves if they're going to have what government they're going to have next week.
Oh, and then America and Japan just announced they had a trade deal.
Which, these days...
Did you see that? They just we've got a trade deal now. They're like, what? They're like, yeah, no, we've agreed all of the principles, we'll sign it in a month.
Yeah.
They're like, but didn't you just kill this? Didn't... What? Like, that thing came out of nowhere.
Yeah, they killed it until... I think it was... seems to be decided on the back that if we're going to go to war, if we're going to have a trade war with China, we better not have one with Japan at the same time. And
but I've been reading some of the Asian press about it, and there's just this sort of, we're doing what now? Like, yeah, we've got a trade deal now, let's just sign it.
Yeah, just deal with it. Yeah.
So yeah, it's just that Trump just managed to negotiate a trade deal, and now apparently there were talks like up to a month ago, but nothing had happened, and then just within like a day of getting there, it's just trade deal.
Well, Japanese these days, God love them.
Whether or not it's maybe a bit of an issue for us, because part of the reason we're getting such a good trade deal with the Japanese is because they already worked out what they were willing to give the Americans. Also, we sent Phil Hogan down to them, which has apparently worked out hilariously.
That would.
Apparently they're just not able to deal with Phil Hogan.
There are many people who fall into that category, you know. There are many, many people.
And he's a big guy.
Oh, he's a big guy.
I've loved seeing the photos of him with the Japanese trade delegation, because Phil Hogan is what, like 6'5"?
Well, I don't know if he's 6'5", but he's tall. He's 6'3" anyway.
Just this massive Irish guy.
Somehow the big dome pate head just seems to exaggerated somehow as he's leaning over, slightly shining. Oh, I tell you, it's all good. It's all good fun. It's all good, healthy.
Yeah. So the G7 is meeting. It's descended into total farce. It will continue for a while. Trump is trying to get them to reinvite Russia. They're saying no. They have a problem, however, in that America is hosting it next year, and Trump will still be president, and whoever is hosting it can invite anyone they want.
Absolutely, whoever they like.
So they actually can't stop Russia coming back next year. They would just rather it didn't happen.
Lots of things will be different next year, if we're still here. If we haven't all been burnt to a crisp. But anyway, I suppose. Well, if they're back next week, are we back on Wednesday?
We are back on Wednesday. Yes.
Well, I suppose I look forward to it. I'm always eager to hear what it is we have to say. Anyway, until then, I'm going to wish the good listeners out there have a good week, and squeeze the joy out of these last few days of summer and sunshine before the long, dark winter begins.
Or if you are like me and shaking off the last of an illness, prop yourself up in bed and stare at the hateful sun that is causing you pain.
Man up or die, that's what I say. Okay, bye-bye.
All the best.